Blog Talk Radio.
All right, ladies, buckle up. It's showtime.
You are the worst person I know. I think what I hate most about you is your textbook liberal agenda, how we should legalize pot, man, how big business is crushing the underclass, how homelessness is the biggest tragedy in America. Well, what have you done to help? I work down at the soup kitchen. Never seen you down there. You want to help? Grab a ladle. And by the way, driving a Prius doesn't make you Jesus Christ. Oh, wait, you don't believe in Jesus Christ, or any religion for that matter, because religion is for idiots. Well, who the hell are you to talk down to anyone? But you know what? I can forgive all of that, all of it, if you weren't such a bore. That's the worst of it. You're just a big, sad bore.
Yeah, same bat time, same bat channel. We are here. We are live. It is Risa on the radio right here, 1 minute after the hour on blogtalkradio.com. It is June the 26th, 2012. Now, normally I would play our classic, you know, little theme song that we always play when we have a conversation about the fringe group known as the, you know, gay mafia. But today's story is a sad one, so I'll save it for my other story about the radicalism of the state of affairs when it comes to the gay union. This story is heart-wrenching, and what I find absolutely deplorable is that there's been no media coverage of it. And if there has been, it's been minuscule at best. I found two major newspapers that wrote about the story, the San Francisco Gate and the New York Post. I'm sure there are other outlets. I believe the New York Daily News may have had a story on it, but it's a story that comes out of San Francisco. A lot of you may not even know the individual I am talking about when I just start discussing him. But the number is 347-308-8701. I want to talk about why the gay media is not talking about this and why the liberal media is ignoring it. And they should be. I want to give you a little background on this. As many people remember, years and years and years ago, when conversations about homosexual lifestyles were really starting to hit the media, the opposition was always making claims, you know, we don't want gay people around our children. You'll probably remember Proposition 6 back in the 70s, before the election of Ronald Reagan. Proposition 6 was a law. Proposition 6 was a law that they were trying to get passed where homosexuals could not be teachers. And Ronald Reagan wrote an op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times talking about how this law should be outlawed. It should be, you know, there should be no law. There should be no Proposition 6 because he was following the Constitution, saying that no person should be denied a job because they are gay. One of the people who was a part of this movement was a man by the name of, and let's make sure I get all of his information right here, because I want to be able to break this down for you, a man by the name of Larry Brinken. And Larry Brinken, who's 66 years old, worked for the San Francisco Human Rights Commission. The Human Rights Commission is a group that tries to, of course, stop discrimination. Everyone deserves their human rights. He is also a gay pioneer. For some 30 years now, he's been at the forefront of the gay rights movement. He had a 22-year tenure at the Human Rights Commission, and Larry Brinken is best known for championing equal rights for gays and lesbians. He helped craft San Francisco's groundbreaking Equal Benefits Ordinance, the EBO, which became a national model for workplace equality. Now, I believe that he retired from the Board of Supervisors They said, oh, yeah, upon Brinken's retirement, the Board of Supervisors approved a resolution declaring the week of February 1st, 2010, Larry Brinken Day. Larry Brinken Week, I apologize, in San Francisco, saying his dedication to the advance of civil rights for all people has never stopped. Well, Larry Brinken has been arrested. And the allegations are startling, ladies and gentlemen. Are startling. I'll read the story from the San Francisco Gate. Goes a little something like this. San Francisco police have arrested veteran gay rights advocate Larry Brinken in connection with felony possession of child pornography. Brinken, who's 66, worked for the San Francisco Human Rights Commission before his retirement in 2010, was taken into custody on Friday night. He spent the night in jail before he was released on bail, according to a spokeswoman for the Sheriff's Department. The District Attorney's Office will decide on Tuesday, today, whether to file charges. District Attorney spokeswoman Stephanie Ong Stillman said, "We're still reviewing the case." Police say that Brinken had pornographic images, some that appear to show children as young as 1, 2, or 3 years old being sodomized and performing sexual acts on adult men. In email attachments linked to the account, according to the search warrant served by San Francisco police, representatives of America Online contacted authorities after coming across email attachments from one of the subscribers' accounts containing what they believe to be child pornography. The Los Angeles Police Department, which was assigned to the case, traced the IP address associated to the account called Zach3737@AOL.com to Brinken, a San Francisco resident, according to court records. Los Angeles police forwarded the case to the San Francisco police. San Francisco investigators say the account was registered to Brinken and that he paid for the email service with his credit card. Police provided two examples of email messages from last year in which Zach3737 provides disturbing descriptions of the exploited sexual acts. The email account also is linked to a Yahoo discussion group on sexual exploitation of young boys and girls, according to the search warrant. Executing the search warrant on Friday, police seized two laptops, a desktop computer, videos, a floppy disk, and thumb drives from Brinken's Walker Street home. Now, I haven't even given you the worst part of this, as if there could be. Again, this is a man who is an advocate for equal rights for all. In the New York Post article, it reads, Brinken, 66, best known for fighting for equal rights on the behalf of the LGBT community, was booked in San Francisco County on Friday night and posted bail and was released on Saturday. The San Francisco Police Department, you know, got videos, VHS tapes, and floppy disks from Brinken and his husband's home, according to a search warrant. They say that Brinken had exchanged emails that contained pornographic photographs of children. The emails also contain graphic, sexual, and racist commentary, including, "I loved especially the nigger two-year-old getting nailed." That was described in the email exchange. Referred to a little child as a nigger getting nailed. Now, in lieu of the Jerry Sandusky case, why isn't this story being reported? This has all the flavor that the liberal media loves when it comes to child sex cases. But they're not reporting it because it's one of their own. They can destroy this person with just one news report, referring to a molested black child as a nigger. There's also some email exchanges about some white supremacy rants. But this is a gay rights leader. Now, I don't have to tell you why it won't be reported and why you'll never know about it. It's quite obvious. See, Jerry Sandusky, they don't have to care about him. Going after Jerry Sandusky is easy. College sports, you know, privileged deities who work in that field, sports figures, sports coaches, you know, rising them on their shoulders, you know, the gridiron battle. Liberals hate that. Winning and losing, scoring points, knocking the other guy down to the ground. They hate that. To villainize that is something they celebrate doing. Yes, we're going to take that cracker down. But I'm not going to ask that ridiculous question like, you know, which one do you think is worse? Oh, they're equally horrendous. That goes without a doubt. The acts are equally horrendous. But in a culture that says we have to put a stop to this, and in order to put a stop to this, we have to expose it. Why not expose it when it's a gay civil rights leader? And I use that word civil rights tongue-in-cheek. They are not civil rights leaders. And they know why this hurts them, because when we live in an area where we can demonize the Catholic Church for a sex scandal and bring that giant down, you know, priests molest little boys. It's the whole Catholic Church, damn it, and the scandal they covered up. So they set that narrative. That's what everyone seems to be talking about. I'm pretty sure our good friend Mike in Florida will agree with that. That's right. Those Catholics talking about Christ and Christianity and a fake Bible. Yeah, tear those suckers down. Well, why wouldn't they want to tear down the LGBT community with one of their leaders? One of their leaders getting caught in a scandal like this was referring to a molested black child as a nigger. Why isn't it relevant? But we're never ever, I'll never ever let this story go. I am going to drive this story home, because right now it's my plight to make sure that it's exposed. You can catch this diatribe on Reese on the Radio, because I will be downloading the audio and putting it on the website. I put the story on my website. It got hits in seconds. All I had to do was put in the words child porn, nigger, gay community. They searched it like wildfire. Because that's what these people are out there searching for on the net. Stories about it. Advocacy groups are out there trying to figure out who's the next child molester. But the media doesn't report this? The mainstream media ignores this story? This wouldn't fit the profile of a horrendous child pornography story? A child abuse story? This wouldn't pique the interest of mainstream media to get to the bottom of? This wouldn't make them ask questions about this guy? But we know why. The hidden agenda is, we don't want people to think that all gays are like this. But we can make people think that there are sports coaches out there who are like this. We can push that. Talk about that all day. Let's get our parents scared of putting their kids in organized sports. Let's make our kids afraid to be choir boys and choir girls and join the church. Let's get them afraid of joining those establishments. But we can't put the gay community on blast like that. We have to protect them. So here you have it, bottom line. Here is the gay community being protected Here is a gay activist who's an alleged child porn watcher, skeevy piece of garbage, who's out there exchanging emails and photos with other perverts, and the media decides that we're going to protect him. I thought the idea was to protect all children. I thought that was the idea, to protect all children, no matter who the perpetrators are. This is a huge news story, and you know it. This is a huge story. Not just because of what was exchanged in the emails, but who's responsible? Who's being called into question here? What does this say about this individual? So many questions have to be asked. Racism? Child porn? Associated with somebody who's supposed to be seeking equal rights for individuals? Young and old, big and small, man and woman, black, white, Asian, Latino, but yet no word. Nothing being said. It's not disheartening, it's just so typical. It's just so typical. They should be disappointed. But that's okay, because we're going to follow this till the wheels come off, the son of a bitch. So expect us to stay on top of it. Keep logging on to ReeseOnTheRadio.com. Check out the story for yourself. And we'll be back shortly. It's Reese on the Radio. 17 minutes after. And you'd be stunned at some of the people who call up to spend some time with Reese on the Radio.
He is the godfather of entertainment, Mr. Michael Lohan. Mr. Lohan!
Reese, I have to stop laughing before we continue. I don't know how to respond to this. Am I in the Twilight Zone?
you are in the Twilight Zone. On the phone with us right now on Reese on the Radio is the connoisseur of the Hollywood biz, the father of the famed actress Lindsay Lohan. Mr. Michael Lohan is on the show on Reese on the Radio. Thank you for joining us today, sir.
No, thanks for having me, Reese. It's going to be a lot of fun, I can tell already.
Oh, man, you have no idea how much fun we're going to have today. It's Reese on the Radio, weeknights, right here on blogtalkradio.com.
Mary, Mary, why you bugging?
James, you're on the air?
Yep.
Before you say anything, you are just going to come clean right now, okay? I'd like to know the adult beverage you're enjoying.
Beverage? Yeah, I'm drinking beer.
What kind of beer are you drinking, James? Is it a 211?
Oh, yes.
You're drinking a 211?
Yes.
You're drinking 211 Steel Reserve.
Right now.
The reason why it's called Steel Reserve, and it's called 211 for that matter, is that the police code 211 means robbery in progress.
And don't let me tell you what that 211 has stolen from you tonight, my man.
It's Reese on the Radio, weeknights, right here on blogtalkradio.com.
The Obama attack machine has started, spending millions to sling mud or oil at Mitt Romney. Why? Because in the five states where Obama's attacking Romney, gas prices have roughly doubled. But Obama's mud can't cover up his failed energy policies. Policies that are hurting small businesses and working families. America deserves solutions, not attack ads covering up Obama's failures. 4 years of failed leadership are all we can afford. Send a message.
Hey guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Jared Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Bleu.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
And I promise you, none of these people listen to my show. But here's some people who do.
Hey, Reese.
Hey,
I don't think you're a buffoon.
Thank you, dear. George, you're Robert Reese.
Hi there, Reese.
Hello, George.
Please let me do the talking today.
George, you're going to be brief.
I respect what you said because you know something, you're being honest.
Hey, so I'm glad that you're bringing up what's most important, and that is the issues and where people stand and what they have for experience.
It's Reese on the Radio, weekdays right here on blogtalkradio.com.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
This is the real state of our union. But you won't hear stories like those at President Obama's address tonight. The unemployed don't get tickets to sit next to the First Lady. Instead tonight, the President will do what he does best. He'll give a nice speech.
The idea of America endures.
A lot of memorable phrases in it.
But our future is hopeful.
But he won't give you the hard numbers.
Our journey goes forward. And the state of our union is strong.
Three years ago, we measured candidate Obama by his hopeful promises and his slogans. Today, President Obama has amassed an actual record of debt, decline, and disappointment. I'd use the State of the Union to lay out an agenda that will get our country back on track and get our fiscal house in order. We need to nominate someone who is an experienced leader, who has the qualities of leadership, the character, the judgment, the seriousness, the sobriety, the capacity demonstrated time and time again as a leader to help guide our party at a critical time and make sure that we hold on to the House, that we capture the Senate, and that we get back the White House and restore to America what is rightfully ours. A great nation, united, free, and prosperous for our kids and for their kids. Thank you so very much.
There's Dr. Oz, there's Dr. Phil, there's Dr. Drew, there's Dr. Joy Brown. It seems like everybody's got an opinion, but I'm going to leave it to the real professionals. Call up at 347-308-8701 to give me your take. It's my problem, you deal with it. Right here on Therapy Thursdays on Reese on Radio, on blogtalkradio.com, weeknights on blogtalkradio.com.
What is a boy to do?
President Barack Obama named himself one of the country's four best presidents. Better than George Washington, John F. Kennedy, and even Ronald Reagan. But Mr. President was just being modest. He's in fact America's best president at piling on debt. So good that he has managed to pile on nearly as much debt as all the previous presidents combined. All he needed was just 4 years to outspend 220 years of history. We can't afford four more years of America's best president.
Warning, the sound you're about to hear can be devastating to your ear.
I love it, I love it, I love it, I L-O-V-E.
You're listening to Reese on the Radio right here on blogtalkradio.com. June 26, 2012. I almost said 2008. I have no idea why. Anyway. Okay. So now, I can make a mention of our famous music that we always play whenever we talk about. Whenever we talk about this group.
Where's the runway? I have
Don't know exactly how to take it other than this was a dumb idea. Because anytime I see a business do something partisan, it always baffles me because I go, you know, these people are supposed to be the brightest minds when it comes to business. You would think that. But then I go into this and I start watching these people do things and I go, maybe they're not that bright.
There's not a lot of people in the world with common sense.
Well, common sense is one thing, but business sense is a lot.
But common sense...
isn't often that common.
Isn't often that common, and is a necessity for every and any aspect of your life,
okay.
Business or personal.
I like the way you put that. I agree with you, Mary.
I know, I agree too, but when it comes to business, it takes not so much common sense. It takes pretty much a formula.
Mm-hmm.
A formula. When you decide who it is that you want to sell your product to,
but in order to come up with that formula,
you don't
JC?
Decide on one particular group or another. You want to sell your product to everybody. What's the sense of getting in business if you're just gonna target a specific group or type of consumer?
Right. But most cases, you know what? If you sell bikinis, you know you're selling them to women, so there's a target audience. You know, if you're selling slacks, you know that you're selling to selling to men. You know, there are things, of course, that are in this world that you are targeting things to, and then there are things that are general. And the reason why I'm bringing
this
up is
gender specific,
you know, age specific, even, you know, toys are age specific. You know, unless you're one of those people who collect action figures. Because then it's not so much. But then, in this particular case, this is why I find it so odd. The Oreo company.
Nabisco.
Has this... No, they're Kraft.
No, they're not.
Oreo is Kraft, my
dear.
It
is not.
Oreo...
Maybe it is
Kraft. It's Kraft. Trust me. Kraft Foods.
They're Kraft now?
Yes, they are.
Weren't they Nabisco before?
But they are Kraft now, Kraft Foods. Now, I already know what the agenda is, because remember, Kraft Foods was one of the first organizations that joined Michelle Obama and this whole health kick, you know, thing that she's been promoting for the past 3 years. Kraft Foods was the first group to join them, I believe, in 2009, maybe 2010, this whole health food initiative. So when I saw this, it wasn't far-fetched for me. Kraft Foods. He's creating a lot of drama because they made an ad today that is supposed to be promoting gay pride. And they come up with a poster for the gay pride Oreo and put it on their Facebook page. Oreo posted the Photoshop picture. Wait. Oreo posted the Photoshop picture of an Oreo cookie stuffed with rainbow colored layers and frosting. Monday evening with the caption, "Proudly support love." Now, over the past 17 hours, more than 157 people have liked the image. 40,000 people have shared it, and 20,000 have commented on it. But while many of the comments were supportive, some Facebook users pledged to boycott the cookie because of the post. One person wrote, "I'll never buy Oreo again." Disgusted with Oreos, wrote another, "Being gay is an abomination in God's eyes, and I won't be buying them anymore." Now, first of all, this story is posted by ABC News. I'm sure there were other people who opposed to this ad that didn't have anything to do with what they thought about God. But of course, they wouldn't print that here. Because I'm sure that most people said, don't involve yourself in this issue. You sell cookies to kids. Nobody cares that you support gay love. If that's what you support in a business, you know, support one of your other items that you only sell to adults, and then you can promote that. But not cookies. Cookies is a kid-friendly item. And to say that Oreo is down with gay pride is sending messages to children. Like it or not. And that's not the place of, that's not the place of Oregon.
Yeah, how do you go from commercials with the tennis chick?
It's Serena Williams.
Serena Williams.
Serena and Venus. You got Peyton and Eli.
And Eli. How do you go from that to the Rainbow Coalition?
Yeah, I mean, I don't get it. Go ahead.
In all honesty, I don't think that Oreo is really has been targeted to kids in a long time.
You got it.
They've always had celebrities.
Commercials all over the place with kids. Competing on dunking with their parents.
Yeah, I mean,
and competing on and testing how do you eat your Oreo and who can eat their Oreo faster. And of course they've.
I mean, their marketing is towards kids.
Okay. But any marketing genius would know that if you're going to market towards kids, why not stick a cartoon character, or something behind it?
They don't have to in the Oreo's case. They've got a marketing campaign that teaches kids, you know, the whole thing, twist it, lick it, dunk it. The whole idea is a kid-oriented. It's a fun cookie. It's a cookie geared towards children. No matter what you do, if you were to look at all the advertising, I promise you right now, if you go on YouTube and look up Oreo commercials, I'm sure 9 times out of 10, those ads are geared towards kids. Even the sports ones, the ones, as Mary was just talking about, dealing with, sports figures, you know, having the lick off or the Oreo off, whatever that ad campaign was, where the two brothers are going against the two sisters, you know, with the Mannings versus the Williams, the Williams sisters.
And even like in springtime, they come out with spring-colored Oreos.
Yes, Easter.
Easter, St. Patrick's Day.
Right.
They've, you know, more recently come out with the vanilla Oreo, where it's a vanilla cookie with vanilla inside, whatever. Now they have that has chocolate filling. So it is always geared towards kids because, of course, adults eat Oreos, but kids eat cookies and candies and stuff like that are geared towards children.
Exactly. Unless they're things like Pepperidge Farm, which is clearly geared toward adults. Stelladora was another campaign.
A more high class.
Right, exactly.
What they call higher class.
High end. That would be a high end cookie. Right.
Yeah.
Stelladora cookies are geared towards adults. You know, this is just, you know, this is kid marketing, but they shouldn't be injecting themselves into the gay pride thing. I think we talked about Ben and Jerry's. I don't care really what Ben and Jerry's does because Ben and Jerry's ice cream is clearly geared towards adults. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's a hipster sort of a marketing campaign with them, you know, with their Chunky Monkey and Chubby Hubby, and they came out with that ice cream called the Chubby, what was it, the Hubby Hubby. They changed Chubby Hubby to Hubby Hubby. Well, that's what it is that they do. But Oreo, for me, I don't think there's anybody out there who would disagree that Oreo cookies are primarily geared towards children. I would go.
It's not that I totally disagree, but when I look at cookies and I look at cookies like Dunkaroos, they've got a character to represent it. The key to
cartoon characters
to represent it.
JC.
What's that?
JC, Dunkaroos.
Yes.
Dunkaroos is an off brand of Oreos.
Oh, are they?
Yes.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
I've never heard Dunkaroos. I know who Dunkaroos are, but I didn't think. You mean when you say offshoot? You mean they're owned by the same company or?
No, it's
owned by the same.
No,
parent
it's an
company?
Off brand of Oreos.
I never heard that. You're gonna have to look that one up, JC.
It's like
That's like Betty Crocker. What do you mean an off brand
cookie?
Well, you're saying it's an offshoot of, or you're saying they're owned by...
Yeah,
I know it's an offshoot. It's clearly an offshoot of the Oreo. But Dunkaroos clearly says it's Dunkaroos. That marketing in and of itself sounds like a kid's brand. But Oreo, the whole...
But Dunkaroos are cookies where you dip into the little frosting that you get on the side. They're nothing like Oreos.
Oh, okay.
I thought that you were...
Dunkaroos are like, you know, those... the
like a dipping stick kind of deal?
Yeah, like a little dipstick thing. You can't even compare.
They're actually little round. They're actually little round cookies, but they're made by Duncan Hines.
Oh,
and
is that
what they are? That's related to them. Yeah.
Well, nonetheless, I still think it's disgusting for oil. Now they're claiming, by the way, just for to clear this up. They're claiming that they're not planning on actually putting out a cookie in this fashion, but they just want to show their support for gay pride. But then I'm saying it's still the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, if you shouldn't market yourself as in any way.
You didn't come out with a damn pink. You didn't come out with a pink cookie for cancer.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that's, and again, you know, if you really want to bring awareness to something, a pink cookie supporting breast cancer, I think kids would be on board for that. One kid might have a mom who has breast cancer.
Or a dad that
or
has
a dad.
Breast cancer.
Exactly. Which, you know.
Or a black and blue cookie for bullying, black eyes.
It would be the black cookie with blue frosting in that case, JC.
Yeah.
But would you really market black and blue to promote bullying?
I don't even like the cream inside Oreos. I think the worst thing they've ever done was make those Oreos double stuffed.
That's why I eat Oreos, is for the cream. And the double stuff, they basically they basically took all the damn cream out. It's like buying a thing of cookies that are similar to Oreos from the dollar store. Just like Twinkies, they took all the filling out of the damn Twinkie.
Again, I still think it was stupid by them. I don't think it's going to hurt them too bad if they just knock it off real fast, but it's not something they should
do. Yeah.
It's a great day to have come out with.
They're trying to turn to themselves, if anything.
It was a dumb, dumb move.
It was a great time to have come out with this at the same time that this Chester the Molester with the little 2-year-old and baby getting punched in the butt.
Exactly. Anyway, but
it's Obama's fault.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly whose fault it is. When we come back, we've got George Zimmerman news and Jimmy Kimmel, I apologize, took a shot at Barack Obama last night and the Obama event registry. We'll play it for you when we get back. Stick around. It's Reason on the Radio.
Hi, Bill Maher here. Sarah Palin agreed to do commentary at Fox News, which is actually very similar to her day job, talking to a baby with Down syndrome.
Speaking of dumb f***s,
it's not because they have breasts, it's because they are boobs.
I hope Sarah Palin gets in so that they split the MILF vote.
That's not sexist.
I would like to announce a donation to the Obama Super PAC.
I thought about Malia and Sasha. I want them to be able to speak their mind in a civil and thoughtful way. And I don't want them attacked or called horrible names because they're being good citizens.
I would like to give that PAC $1 million. Sarah Palin, the strange family of inbred weirdos. She fucked Levi over and over until a baby fell out.
The Maverick and the Milk.
They fined CBS $1 million for Janet Jackson's nipple. Think what they could get for Hillary Clinton's cunt. That's not sexist.
All decent folks can agree. The remarks that were made don't have any place in the public discourse.
She is the chair of the Democratic National Committee.
I don't know any woman in America that thinks that being called a slut is funny.
Please welcome Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Being part of a democracy involves argument and disagreements and debate, and there's a way to do it that doesn't involve you being demeaned and insulted.
Speaking of dumb fucks, this is a Category 5 moron we have on our hands, and I am unapologetic.
Top 10 highlights of Sarah Palin's trip to New York City. Number 2, bought makeup at Bloomingdale's, update her slutty flight attendant look.
I'm going to try to lead by example.
During the 7th inning, her daughter was knocked up by Alex Rodriguez.
To send a message to all our young people. I'm going to try to lead by example.
Speaking of dumb squats, Barr decided to help President Obama out and give him a financial boost.
He's donated $1 million.
Last week, I said goodbye to $1 million. I made a contribution to Obama's super PAC. This ends up being a teachable moment.
I wouldn't put anything past this stupid country.
All decent folks can agree the remarks that were made don't have any place in the public discourse. I'm going to try to lead by example in this situation.
You're seeing a president adopt policies which affect our economy based not upon what's right for the American worker, but instead what's right for their politics. The National Labor Relations Board, now stacked with union stooges selected by the president, says to a free enterprise like Boeing, you can't build a factory in South Carolina because South Carolina is a right-to-work state. That is simply un-American. It's political payback of the worst kind. It is wrong for America, and it is something that will stop under my administration. I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Reese on the radio, and we're back 41 minutes after the hour right here on blogtalkradio.com. June the 26th, 2012. And I know no one seems to talk about this anywhere. This is the part that makes me laugh. When I follow the George Zimmerman case, I can't help but be furious. Because the media, you know, they've already been caught with an agenda. They've already been busted. They've already been caught with an agenda. So when they report stories, I can't help but look at them and laugh because they make no sense. Now, there should be a bigger headline on this story. And it should be a smarter headline on this story. But of course, MSNBC.com put it up. It says, quote, police say Zimmerman had chances to defuse situation before shooting Martin. Now, that's the headline. But what's the most important part in the story that they wrote? It turns out that Zimmerman passed a lie detector test. Which is the bigger story?
The lie detector.
Well, of course it is. Of course it's the bigger story. The man's entire credibility has been besmirched. Credibility ripped apart. Lie detector test comes out, says that he passes it, but the story headline is police say Zimmerman had chances to defuse the situation before shooting Martin. You weren't there. You don't know the circumstances. You only get them after the fact, and then you tell him what it is that he could have done. You Monday morning quarterback, and then you tell everybody, oh, at MSNBC, this is what he could have done. He said he could have defused it. But the truth of the matter is that the big story comes out is that he passed the lie detector test. All I'm asking is, what's the bigger story? Go ahead, JC. JC, did you want to ask something?
Yeah, yeah. What was the lie detector test about?
The event of the evening. In fact, if you would like me to, I'll read the story. And I'll tell you that they barely mention it. They say prosecutors released more documents and photos and audiovisual files on Tuesday afternoon from the case of neighborhood of volunteer George Zimmerman. Anyway, Zimmerman told police that he saw Martin walking, followed him in his vehicle, passed him without identifying himself, called the police non-emergency line, lost sight of Martin as Martin ran towards his father's home, allegedly, followed Martin on foot, and then was confronted by Martin, who attacked him when Zimmerman reached into his pocket for his cell to call 911. Report shows Zimmerman passed a lie detector test called a computer voice stress analyzer. Such tests are popular with police departments, but usually are not admissible as evidence in court. The police detective concluded that Zimmerman's actions were inconsistent with someone who was afraid of Martin, and that Zimmerman had several chances to end the encounter without violence. How are you going to determine that? You weren't there. And all the evidence shows, heads bashed in, you saw the video of him reenacting what took place days later. In fact, a day later, reenacting what took place at the shooting. He's got a bandage on his nose, and he's got bandages on the back of his head. Photos have proved that. Everyone said at the beginning of this, he doesn't look like he's got a scar on him. He doesn't have a scratch on him. He looks fine. What's this BS about? He got his ass whipped. Everyone said that. And now they're looking at the video, and everybody's sha-sha-sha-sha-sha. And MSNBC is going, but police say he could have avoided it. How do you know? Based on what? That's an opinion. How do you know he could have avoided shooting him? Zimmerman says that Trayvon was reaching for his gun when he was squirming on the floor. His jacket went up. His gun was visible. It looked like he was reaching for it. He grabbed it himself, and he shot him. If that's not my life's in danger, I don't know what is. If that's what the story, that's what the story is, and that's what, what's happened, that's a great argument for. But how could he have avoided it? He grabbed his gun and he fired it. He thought.
Well, what they're saying is he could have avoided the entire.
But Zimmerman
violent episode.
Right, but Zimmerman suggests that, and this is another story that people fail to realize. Now, I didn't play the audio because I have the audio, and it's just so poor that you can't really hear it. But George Zimmerman says that when Trayvon got off on top of him and George was screaming, help, 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 he put his hands over his mouth and nose and said, shut the F up, shut the F up. And then he says when his gun appeared, he said, you're going to die tonight, mother. And then reached for it, and that's when he pulled it up. Now, how could he have avoided that? Come on, Trayvon. Listen, man, just take your Skittles and watermelon juice and just go on about your way.
I don't have watermelon juice.
Come on, man. We don't have to go like this, man. I thought you were somebody else, man. It's all right. Come on, Trayvon, or whatever your name is.
Trayvon!
Well, I would have called him Black Boy. Come on, Black Boy. I'm just a hard-working Hispanic white guy. Just trying to get along.
I got papers.
Come on, man. Yeah, man. I belong in this country. I'm not an immigrant. I don't need no amnesty. We don't need no stinking badges. Come on, man. Can't we just defuse this? Can't we all get along? Well, that's not what he should have said.
Oh, can't we all just get along?
Yeah.
Did you hear about...
What?
Did you hear about
Rodney King?
Rodney King's family trying to raise money, talking about it's going to cost them $20,000 to bury Rodney King?
Stop lying.
Yes, they did. They set up a trust fund.
It's going to cost $20,000 to bury them?
Mm-hmm.
That's not the... Come on, are you kidding me? That's not the average burial rate.
I don't know what the average burial rate is.
You can bury somebody for $5,000. I think that's cheap. JC, I hate to bring up your personal life, but your grandmother and your mom, I mean, they're passed away. Even your dad. I mean, I'm only suggesting this because you have more experience in this stuff than I do. But you know, what's the average funeral cost?
The average funeral cost. Wow.
Well, considering your love,
my grandma. Not my reason. You know, I mean, since you've known me, I've lost my grandfather, my mother, my father, and this Saturday I'm burying my grandmother.
Exactly. So you got a slew of people who you can reference to. So what's
and
the average?
Average funeral cost is about $10,000.
Okay, so about $10,000.
Yeah.
And the reason why Rodney King's party family wants $20,000 is somebody's thinking about partying.
Of course.
Yeah.
Somebody wants to have a little party for Rodney. A little get down.
And even the black folks are not giving them their money.
Nobody's giving them money?
I don't know who's giving them money, but I know that they were talking about on, I think it was Russ Paul on the Russ Paul morning show.
Right.
This morning.
Right.
Russ Paul was like, I'm not giving them no money.
Really?
How do I know that they're going to do the right thing? And didn't he get a settlement? Where's the money he had?
Absolutely.
Where
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, where's his girlfriend? How come they don't have any money to bury him?
Do you think they'll play this song at his funeral?
You know it's hard out here for a pimp. When he's trying to get this money for the friend.
don't know. I just wondered. I'm sorry. I don't feel in this. So if black people are saying they ain't giving Rodney King no money.
Yep.
Damn.
They're like, we'll get the money to the funeral home.
Wow, they don't even trust his family with the money to bury
him. That's the whole reason why they don't want to give him
the
money. They don't trust his family.
They don't even know his family.
Well, I don't know.
That's horrible.
They get that old white woman, that old bus lady.
Yeah, man, isn't that
$1,000?
You know, you want to talk about that's. You know what, Mary? You are brilliant tonight. You are just connecting. You're just clicking them together. Isn't that amazing? All that old woman.
Is she drinking 211? I mean, is she drinking 211?
No, she ain't drinking 211. But no, she's connecting all the dots. Think about it. She's connecting everything to everything. She went, Rodney King got his ass whipped, became what most would consider, I hate to use the word iconic, but he became a figure of the L.A. riots. Even Al Sharpton.
He became a staple in
history.
In
sure.
history, because he will always be remembered. Those riots will always be remembered.
For the Rodney King beat it. A footnote of the L.A. riot.
Exactly.
And black people won't give him a dime, but a woman who got called a fat bastard on a school bus has grossed over $400,000.
Who got called a fat bastard on a school bus?
You haven't seen this video? Dude,
no.
It's been seen by over 2 million people, J.C.,
And what bus company? Where is this bus company?
All right, listen.
Okay, wait.
I'll tell you a story. 68-year-old grandmother. She's got like 8 grandkids. She's a school bus monitor, and she rides with public school for a bunch of middle school kids. One of the kids thought to himself, I'm going to videotape us harassing this woman, us bullying her. I'm going to put it online so we can get famous, so it can go viral. They put it online. People saw it and were outraged. So the boys have now been punished. I think one of the kids, I think they were put on some suspension. One kid might get kicked out or some junk like that. There's a whole bunch of outrage going on with the kids. The kids have also received death threats.
And it wasn't just boys. It was girls.
Well, they're saying only 4 boys were actually who were identified.
She has a girl.
I do. I hear girls too. But well, we might be wrong because one of the boys sound like a little girl, by the way. But these 4 boys have been identified, and they've been scrutinized by the school and the whole nine. But now people are threatening them. They got death threats and the whole 9 yards. But a guy saw the story on the news and put up a website for people to give this woman a severance pay for the crap she has to deal with
for a vacation,
saying, you know, this woman deserves a vacation. They had only planned to raise like $5,000 for her. It's soared to $400,000+, and now they're using it as a retirement money.
And poor Rodney King can't even get a
Rodney damn, King can't get 20 grand?
Can't even get a cafe.
Damn! Man took an ass whipping. The man took an ass whipping to get a police car cam on the front of the LAPD's cars. The man took a beating. The man changed.
Listen. The bottom line, nigga, that nigga couldn't get a goddamn Popeye's chicken coupon from me.
Come on, he can't get something for the ass whipping at least? Forget about the other stuff. The man took an ass whipping.
Look.
I know, everybody, there are going to be people out there ragging on me going, weren't you just crapping on this guy? You called him a skid mark in society. Yes, I did. If you can't tell my sarcasm here, something's wrong with you. But well, for crying out loud, man. I mean, give the guy a decent
I should have put up a website for... Hey, my mom used to do that before she passed. That was the job she was doing. She retired, but she had become a school bus monitor.
Oh, really?
And she was... Yeah, and she was with high school students. And, you know, my mom, anybody will tell you, if you knew my mom was... She was the spitting image of and had the attitude of Della Reese in... Harlem Nights.
In Harlem Nights. Okay, all right.
Right. You're spitting in each other. And one day my mom went to work and they had taken her off of her usual route with the high school students because of some shortages that they had. And one thing my mom's favorite word was, why don't you stop acting damn retarded? That was her favorite line. And they put her on a little pickle bus.
The short bus?
Right. And she forgot what bus she was on. And the kids began acting up. You know, the little bus with the tinted windows.
She used that line on
my God. I said, Mom, how the hell you get suspended from work at age 68?
And she used a retarded line on a bunch of special needs kids.
She told him, stop acting damn it retarded. And got suspended at age 68. You gotta watch your mouth.
He is retarded.
Oh, that's just awful. All right, so just to give you guys an update, I want to let you know, stick around for the next hour. I don't know much about who our next guest is. I don't. I just read it.
That's a great way
that's
to just, introduce
him. I love that because I don't know much about him. I just know what I know about his bio. But you know, we've been covering the Fast and Furious scandal. Our guest for the next hour is a gentleman by the name of Robert Mazur. He is a former DEA agent and the author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. And he is going to come in and talk about the investigation of Fast and Furious because, you know, I guess he's dealt, you know, as a DEA agent. We're going to get his take on this. Now, whether or not he'll have some insight, I don't know. Whether or not he'll know what this whole gun walking thing is about, that I believe so. But I'm going to ask him about the scandal and where it is now and what he thinks of the gun walking scandal. I'm going to ask him what he thought about the gun walking under the Bush administration, which was called wide receiver. And I'm going to ask him about Fast and Furious and about the contrast. And we'll get some insight because he'll be sort of our specialist, if you will. And we'll talk to him. JC, you've got his number, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got his number. JC will put him on the phone with us. We're going to talk to him for an hour. If you've got any questions, if there's something that I missed, of course, you guys can text me or, you know, not text me, I'm sorry. You can hit me on Twitter or hit me on Facebook to find out, you know, give me your questions and I'll be glad to ask them or just call up. The number's 347-308-8701. Again, his name is Robert Mazur. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and he'll correct me when he comes on. He is a former DEA agent and author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. I have to admit, I hate it when people make their titles this freaking long. I hate it.
Well, the title is The Infiltrator.
Yeah, but then it's that underlying title, because that's what I have to introduce every time. The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. And a lot of you thug niggas out there, y'all will love this, because he's down with Pablo Escobar. You know, the crap all you rappers out there, y'all want to be like. You want to be slinging rock, getting keys overseas. All that. What? I just came up with that. Keys overseas. That's popping in my head. I have no idea. I'm a poet. Don't know it. Holla back, son. Holla back.
Whoop, whoop. Holla back.
All right. So, again, we'll talk to Robert Mazur, former DEA agent, when we get back. So stick around, and we'll talk about this Fast and Furious scandal from a professional, a guy who knows the ins and outs. And we'll try to piece this whole thing together. Stick around. It's Reese on the Radio.
How may I help you, my brother?
Look, I'm here because I can't stand what's happening in this community.
Yes?
Yeah, and somebody has to make a change.
Yes!
Now, brother, will you help me?
Yes, I will!
I wish I could. Damn it, man, I heard the People's Revolutionary Army was once 1,000 strong. Now, what happened?
They got government jobs.
The brothers walked in with guns, came out with jobs.
The brothers weren't mad anymore. Yes, Whitey is something else.
And we're back. It's Reset Radio, 1 minute after the hour right here on blogtalkradio.com, June the 26th, 2012. Thank you for being with us. The number is 347-308-8701 if you'd like to be a part of the program. And we're going to be talking to Robert Mazur, a former DEA agent and author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. And, of course, he is here to talk about the Fast and Furious scandal, right now it's causing a major uproar in Washington. And just to reiterate my position here, you can go to reasonradio.com and you can listen to my comments. The bottom line is that the president is involved, like it or not. Don't care what anybody says, you can't prove to me otherwise. Executive privilege, as far as I'm concerned, implicates the President of the United States in Fast and the Furious. So I'm going to ask our guest a series of questions, but first he'll break down some of the details in Fast and Furious, and I'll go through them with him as well, and what his knowledge is of the Fast and Furious scandal. So welcome to our show today. I believe he likes to call himself Bob. Let's make sure I got his name right. Robert Mazur, am I saying your last name right, sir?
You certainly are.
Okay. Do you like to be called Bob or Mr. Mazur? What's preferable to you?
Bob's fine.
Bob is fine. Okay. Bob, you've got some knowledge as a DEA agent and working with sort of the drug cartels and the banks there for you. You actually brought down one of the biggest banks involved in Pablo Escobar's, money laundering of drug money and all that other stuff. Tell us a little about yourself.
Sure. I was a federal agent for 27 years. During that time, probably 20 of those years, I worked on international drug trafficking and money laundering cases. I was in three agencies. I started in New York with what was then called the Intelligence Division of the IRS. And that's an agency that very few people had ever really heard of. One of their biggest things that they are proud of is their involvement in doing the documentation that led to the prosecution of Al Capone. It's a group of accountants who are really gun carriers and badge carriers, and they work with the other agencies to put together the money trails that relate principally the cases that I worked on when I was in New York were drug traffickers, corrupt politicians, organized crime figures, that type
now,
of stuff.
Now, is this the same group that made Elliot Ness famous?
Yes, it is.
Okay,
yes,
all right. Yeah, I know a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the first cases that I got exposed to when I came on the job was a case that became a story in a movie, American Gangster, starring Denzel Washington.
Oh.
The story of Frank Lucas, who was the biggest heroin trafficker in the Northeast back in the early 70s, and he was bringing heroin back into the United States in the body bags of dead soldiers from Vietnam and making huge millions and millions of dollars from the sale of heroin in New York. And we had the money side of that, and so we were watching the couriers and saw them actually carrying duffel bags full of cash into what was then Chemical Bank in New York, and the bank was laundering the money for him. So we made a prosecution on the Chemical Bank, and it really stuck with me how important these international banks are to the power and success of these drug organizations, because those piles of cash have a limited value and a limited power. But when you get that into the banking system, that enables you to create front companies and means of making payments that otherwise appear legal to buy off military or law enforcement personnel or whoever you want to do. buy off, then that's really gives these organizations power. So I gravitated toward working subsequently on the Colombian cartels, initially the Medellin cartel, and we made the cases traditionally, you know, wiretaps, search warrants, informants, historical cases, and came to realize that really the most effective tool that we thought we could use would be a long-term undercover technique. And so I volunteered to be a long-term undercover. I went through undercover school. I was blessed with some great training mentors like Joe Pistone, the former FBI agent who the book and movie Donnie Brasco is based upon, and other trainers and psychologists who vet the candidates who want to be long-term undercovers. After getting through the undercover schools, then went to put together a sophisticated front that took about 18 months to put together, emerging as a totally verifiable, separate identity and embedded in active businesses, real operating businesses that were run by informants or concerned citizens who embedded me in their companies, a finance company in Florida, mortgage brokerage business, but an air charter service with a private jet, jewelry chain with 70 locations on the East Coast, and even a brokerage firm with a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. So that plus two informants within one of the five Italian-American crime families, and that was my cover.
You are what they call in the hood a gangster rapper's wet dream. You are a plethora of information about this industry. I mean, I know some people who would love to talk to you just so they can start their music career.
My book is now in the process of movie development with some very talented people, including a director by the name of Brad Furman, whose last movie of note was The Lincoln Lawyer with Matthew McConaughey, and I think he did a great job in that movie.
We just watched that a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, well, Brad's a young and up-and-coming genius in Hollywood, and we've kind of hit it off, and actually I'm helping him now on a movie they're shooting in Puerto Rico called Runner Runner that Justin Timberlake and Ben Affleck are in, and it's about offshore internet gambling, and so we're hopefully his next project will be the movie development of my book.
Okay, that's great. Now, you're on the show because you are here to talk about the gun running scandal, Fast and Furious, and your extensive knowledge in sort of this whole gun running idea work. Of course, the cartels that are in Mexico are drug cartels. And the bottom line is, as we know, this was a scheme to run guns down to the cartels, trace the guns, allegedly, to get those guns to the cartels, and then, of course, allegedly, arrest some of those key figures in the cartels and bring them to justice. Is that how you understand it?
Yes, it's one of the most ill-conceived, ridiculous plans that I've ever heard of as far as a federal undercover operation. You know, a lot of people like to criticize Wide Receiver, which was a similar operation that let guns walk. At least they made an effort to try to track those with high-tech capabilities. Even that, they realized after doing that during 2006 and 2007, that the technology wasn't there for that to be able to be done, and they shut that operation down, knowing full well at the time that was not a well-conceived plan, because
you know,
putting guns in the hands of killers.
Right, and it's interesting you say that, because what I always note is that the administration then, the Department of Justice, or ATF for that matter, who ran Wide Receiver, even though it led to some, I believe it was 1,600 arrests, and they did track each and every gun with RFID devices, you know, radio frequency IDs. That was very, very popular. After September 11th, people started using them everywhere. Some people were putting them in their kids, for crying out loud. When the gun runners started to realize that the RFID was on these guns, they were ripping them off. Even though they arrested some 1,600 people, it was still considered a failure because it never led to any arrests of any major cartel figures, and even though they did it in congruence or in conjecture, if you will,
with the Mexican government, they still considered a failure, even though, you know, over 1,000 people were arrested. They understood it was ill-conceived. So it begs the question now, why in 2009 run this operation again?
Well, you know, part of this problem is that in my view, you know, let's take a look at the history of ATF, the agency. It was previously part of the Treasury Department, along with two agencies that I was in, the U.S. Customs Service, that now is Department of Homeland Security, mm-hmm. and the Internal Revenue Service. And there's other agencies that were in Treasury. But ATF was pretty well known to be running fast and loose. Not that the employees were not very, very well intended and very motivated to do the right thing, but from the standpoint of guidelines and oversight, ATF was known to be somewhat of a lone wolf when it came to oversight. And, you know, when we did undercover at Customs, when we did long-term undercover operations, for example, the one I address in the book, this is an operation where I'm going to be committing crimes. I'm laundering money for the purposes of identifying people who are involved in command and control of the Medellin cartel, and to identify money launderers, and with a lot of great intention at the end. But what we did do in that case, and what should be done in these cases when agencies violate the law, is that we obtained what's called an attorney general's exemption, which is a written application to the attorney general citing exactly what crimes we were going to need to commit, and getting an exemption from prosecution for committing those crimes because of the benefit that would much outweigh the crime that would be committed in laundering drug proceeds. Unlike that approach with respect to ATF, for some reason or another, the powers that be, even today, didn't find it necessary for there to be a strict attorney general's oversight in not only allowing guns to fall in the hands of criminals, but to allow those guns to cross borders and go into another nation where they could be used to commit other crimes. To me, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And, you know, to a lot of the agents who were involved in this operation, because you need to recognize that agents around the country who were ATF agents were rotated through Phoenix in order to help support the intensive surveillance that allegedly was going on to try to follow these guns. Now, so there were many agents who came in, including one of the whistleblowers who came there, John Dodson, who recognized that what was going on was unconscionable and began to make it very clear to those involved in the oversight within ATF that what was going on was not proper, that it needed to stop. There's even, if you go online, you can find emails that were issued by Dodson's supervisor, a guy by the name of David Voth, V-O-T-H, where he speaks about the dissension in the ranks, about what they're doing, and
telling
says, hey, this has been blessed all the way from Washington.
Right, telling them that you can pretty much find another job or fall in line.
Yeah, I think his comment was that if you wanted to be a jailer in a local county jail, you could make $30,000. In other words, saying shut up.
Right.
You know, when I was in Customs, and when I worked for the government, you know, I can say a lot of things now I couldn't say before because I'm no longer a badge carrying, gun carrying agent, and I'm retired.
Right.
But even when I was an agent, not just me, but many people who are agents consider themselves extremely responsible to the public. You take an oath, and you take that oath to the citizens of the United States. Mm-hmm. I never cared what color my badge was, which agency I was in. My goal was to do the best job I could every single day for my family, for my neighbors, for the people I don't even know who I walk to on the streets.
Right.
That's who I really serve as an agent. And these agents who voiced complaints about what they were seeing deserve some credit for having the courage to stand up and do that. When I was involved with Customs in this undercover operation, I wound up ultimately resigning and going on to another agency.
Oh, wow.
I did that because I believed that my senior officials within the agency broke the law. What they did months before I, you know, more than a month before I was finished working on a long-term undercover operation, dealing with people who would have cut my heart out if they knew who I really was. Mm-hmm. They were in meetings with NBC News, orchestrating international press releases and
wow.
press conferences. And the whole goal behind that really was in an effort to further their own personal careers and to further the personal careers of the people whose coattails that they were riding in Washington, D.C. They wanted to see a particular person become the first drug czar because
right.
they had ingratiated themselves on him, and this was their ticket to go on more. You know,
right.
agents have responsibilities as citizens when they see this type of stuff, not to break ranks and not to
be insubordinate,
say things to the press,
or to be
but they need to stand up and tell the truth.
Right.
They need to stand up and tell the truth.
So we
have a group of people who stand up and tell the truth within ATF, but then you have their supervisors who tell them to sit down, or they're going to wind up working for one-fourth the pay in a local county jail. And at the same time, we have a group of people in the Department of Justice who are recognizing as they begin to get ready to unseal indictments and go forward with prosecutions that were part of wide receiver, that they are going to be in a position to start speaking about the fact that the ATF is letting guns walk and knowing that these guns are going to Mexico.
Well,
and we have a trail of emails,
from
the people at the top of the Department of Justice.
Let me just make sure that if anyone is just joining us, we're on the phone with Robert Mazur, the former DEA agent and author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel, and we're discussing Fast and Furious. You're going into an area where that's the root of where I wanted to go. Now, these emails that are about to be released, and there have already been two emails that have been released so far. I believe CBS News has been the only organization or news organization that has talked about them. Every other place has been alternative media. I got to ask you about this whole deal with ATF and letting these guns walk, because I believe that there is an agenda to have these guns walk. It can't be as simple as let's help the cartel. Now, I'm going to propose something to you, and you tell me if there's any possibility that this could be true. There is much talk that letting these guns walk in Fast and the Furious was to further an agenda for the President of the United States, or if not, Eric Holder in the Department of Justice, to put forth this attack towards Second Amendment rights, and in particular, automatic weapons ban from the Clinton era?
Yes. And the 50 caliber rifles that were also let loose under Fast and Furious.
Right. Do you believe that there is any truth to these rumblings? Because people like Darrell Issa, Republican of California, has not made any suggestion. But there have been others in the media who are saying, look, this president in April of 2009 – in a press conference with Felipe Calderon, the president of Mexico, said some junk about 90% of the weapons that were recovered at Mexican crime scenes were coming from the United States, and fact-checkers proved that that wasn't even true. It was 90% of only 17% of the guns that were found, or that were brought back to the U.S. So it was actually a small amount of guns, and that what this president and this Department of Justice was trying to do was to promote that narrative by actually pushing guns to Mexico, have them found at crime scenes, and when they were identified, oh, look at these automatic weapons coming from the United States, and then, of course, have the American people be outraged and then put this assault weapons ban into effect. Do you believe that there's any truth to that? Because I'm tending to agree with that that thesis.
Well, I can see how people string that theory together. I mean, I'm a guy who was trained on facts, so I'm looking at facts in what Senator Grassley and Congressman Issa have been scraping to pull together. And my thought is, with respect to the conspiracy that you just suggested, I haven't seen the facts, but I don't, I'm not saying that it is or it doesn't, and it does or it doesn't exist. What I do believe we have here, unequivocally, is we have a situation where the Department of Justice knew full well exactly what was going on with Fast and Furious, knew exactly that ATF, at least in the Phoenix Field Division, were letting guns walk, and they were going into Mexico. And they just stepped right in the footsteps of Richard Nixon and Watergate and decided that they were going to try to make it appear that they didn't know what was really going on. That's what I think the facts suggest, because I look at these emails on mm-hmm. April 30th of 2010 between Lanny Brewer and one of his subordinates. And it's clear. It's absolutely clear. They know exactly what is going on. Fast forward 10 months later, and an official letter comes to Senator Grassley from the Department of Justice, claiming that the ATF makes every effort to interdict weapons that have been purchased illegally and prevent their transportation to Mexico. That was a false statement, and Lenny Brewer has since appeared before Congress and admitted that that's not that's a false statement.
It was a lie.
Yet he claims that despite the fact that he knew that, he never shared it with Attorney General Holder, who he meets with on a daily basis, speaks with on a daily basis,
right.
And I find that just unbelievable
that would be the case. But that's my point. My question is, okay, fine. I mean, the facts speak for themselves. Lenny Brewer, the Department of Justice, and Eric Holder, I get the entire idea that they send this memo to Chuck Grassley and say, look, we do everything to interdict them and it's a lie. But my question is, okay, it's clear that they knew the guns were being run. But the bottom line is, why let the guns run? What was the motive behind letting 2,500, I believe it's 2,500, guns walk undetected, or I guess untraced, into Mexico, into there? What would be the reason for doing that? Are we suggesting that the Department of Justice wanted to help the Mexican cartels, arm that Mexican cartel so they can kill, kidnap, murder, whatever the case might be. What's the reason? What was the outcome they wanted for doing this? And it only leads to, the suggestion that this was all, promoted with everything that took place in April of 2009 with that press conference with Felipe Calderon. It just seems too obvious to me, because I couldn't find another reason to allow 2,500 guns to go into Mexico unmarked.
Well, I get the opportunity. I get a kind of a unique opportunity because of being a former federal agent and now being involved in investigative work on the private sector side. But I also do training, and I train law enforcement officers, and I do everything I possibly can to maintain rapport and credibility with the law enforcement community, because I care a lot about them.
Sure.
And so I get the opportunity to talk to active ATF agents off the record about these types of things. And I can tell you that there is a theme in what I hear, that at least in their view, and some of whom were in that very office, whose feeling is that this was a massive management screw-up by a few people within their office who have a history of being very incompetent and not being mindful of what the rules and regs are that they do. Now, that may be hard to imagine, but let me compare it to something that I was personally involved in.
Okay.
And that has to do with some of the facts that are in my book. I'm working undercover as a money launderer. I get enough information that we pass on to our office in Detroit that there is a 18-wheeler tractor-trailer that goes from Miami to Detroit once every couple of weeks and delivers 110 kilos of cocaine to a particular person from whom we're receiving cash. Now, under our operational plan, what should have happened is that the people in Detroit should have, the federal agents in Detroit, should have turned that information over to the local law enforcement officers in such a way that whatever action they took later wouldn't burn the undercover operation. And there are ways to be able to do that.
Sure.
But what they decided to do, was they decided to let the 110 kilos walk. So to my total astonishment, when I went to a briefing, I saw a video of 110 kilograms of cocaine being handed out of a trunk of a car by a Colombian trafficker to Iraqi drug traffickers in Detroit who were not just involved in drug trafficking for their purposes of lining their pockets, but had political views that were terrorist-related. So now I'm sitting there going, how in the world can you possibly tell the American people that you let 110 kilograms of cocaine go on the streets of Detroit and wreck more lives? Granted, there are thousands, tens of thousands of kilos that are out there, but the federal government should not be involved in the distribution of cocaine on the streets of Detroit. Later, this became a major problem, and the Drug Enforcement Administration rightfully took tremendous exception to the fact that the U.S. Customs Service not only allowed that cocaine to go on the street, but never bothered to pick up the phone and call the agency with the principal responsibility for drug enforcement to let them know what was going on. Sometimes individuals do stupid things, and when they do, then other people wind up paying for it. But later what happened was that the Department of Justice tried to justify that. And when they tried to justify it, it's like being in quicksand. You just can't justify it. What you need to do is be completely open and honest, because you know what's really at stake? Your faith in your government is what's at stake. And these people who continue to try to stonewall don't recognize the erosive power that this stonewalling and lack of truthfulness has on the confidence that we, the public, have in them. They have a much greater responsibility than their own career. They need to be thinking about that issue, and that issue is confidence in our government, especially at this time. And unfortunately, I think that part of what happened here is, in fact, terrible decisions made by people. And here's another problem. There's no accountability in the government. People who make these types of stupid decisions wind up either getting promoted away or transferred away. If you take the assistant special agent in charge in the Phoenix office who was most responsible for what was going on in this case, you will find that he was transferred to Washington, D.C. To coordinate what's called the WITSEC program, their witness security program, coordinating with the U.S. Marshals Service. It's a GS-13 position. He's a GS-15. He's allowed to sit there and just kind of roll on getting his paycheck while we all go on trying to figure out what really happened in this operation. That kind of stuff shouldn't be going on.
No, you're absolutely right. We're on the phone with Robert Mazur, the former DEA agent and author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. Bob, can you do me a favor? Can you hold on for a couple of moments? I want to ask you about your book. I want to ask you about the drug trade during, you know, your tenure. I'm going to ask you some I want to ask you some questions that are more or less fact-based, because this is something that you've involved yourself in. You're telling that story about the 100-plus kilos going into Detroit sparked a conversation in me that I want to ask you about drugs going into some of these cities like Detroit, and some of the questions that some people have always asked about drug trade and how it gets into some of our communities and why they're there, who's responsible, who's not infiltrating these things, and why they keep plaguing some of these poorer communities. Can you stick around and talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. Thank you. We'll be back. Stick around, guys, for a couple of seconds. We'll be right back at Tree Center Radio.
Sarah Palin agreed to do commentary at Fox News, which is actually very similar to her day job, talking to a baby with Down syndrome.
Speaking of dumb,
it's not because they have breasts, It's because they are boobs.
I hope Sarah Palin gets in so that they split the MILF vote.
That's not sexist.
I would like to announce a donation to the Obama Super PAC.
I thought about Malia and Sasha. I want them to be able to speak their mind in a civil and thoughtful way. And I don't want them attacked or called horrible names because they're being good citizens.
I would like to give that PAC
$1 million.
Sarah Palin, the strange family of inbred weirdos. Levi over and over until a baby fell out. The Maverick and the MILF. They fine CBS $1 million for Janet Jackson's nipple. Think what they could get for Hillary Clinton's cunt. That's not sexist.
All decent folks can agree. The remarks that were made don't have any place in the public discourse.
She is the chair of the Democratic National Committee.
I don't know any woman in America that thinks that being called a slut is funny.
Please welcome Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Being part of a democracy involves argument and disagreements and debate, and there's a way to do it that doesn't involve you being demeaned and insulted.
Speaking of dumb fucks, this is a Category 5 moron we have on our hands, and I am unapologetic.
Top 10 highlights of Sarah Palin's trip to New York City. Number 2, what makeup at Bloomingdale's updater slutty flight attendant look?
I'm going to try to lead by example.
During the 7th inning, her daughter was knocked up by Alex Rodriguez.
To send a message to all our young people, I'm going to try to lead by example.
Speaking of dumb quads, Marr decided to help President Obama out and give him a financial boost.
He's donated $1 million.
Last week, I said goodbye to $1 million.
I made a contribution to Obama's Super PAC.
This ends up being a teachable moment.
I wouldn't put anything past this stupid country.
All decent folks can agree. The remarks that were made don't have any place in the public discourse. I'm going to try to lead by example in this situation.
You're seeing a president adopt policies which affect our economy based not upon what's right for the American worker, but instead what's right for their politics. The National Labor Relations Board, now stacked with union stooges selected by the president, says to a free enterprise like Boeing, you can't build a factory in South Carolina because South Carolina is a right-to-work state. That is simply un-American. It's political payback of the worst kind. It is wrong for America, and it is something that will stop under my administration. I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Priest on the radio, and we're back 33 minutes after the hour. June 26, 2012, having a very, very in-depth conversation with, I'm sorry, I'm a big fan now, of Mr. Robert Mazur, talking to us about his new book, which I actually can't wait to read now. It's called The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. And we're going to talk to him some more because I've got a lot of questions, Bob, and I'll put you back on. I apologize for that. I've got a lot of questions to you about the drug trafficking, the drug trade. As much as people talk about how it's plaguing the inner city and how you infiltrated each and every one of those groups, especially a group as large as Pablo Escobar's, a lot of people want to know from folks like you who have worked in the government. You know, there are all these theories out there that say, oh, you know, the white man lets the drugs come into our hood. You know what I'm saying, son? White man wants, you know, he's just trying to hold the black man down. I'm sorry, that's just me doing the, you know. As a black guy, I do a horrible black guy. But what is in your personal experience, what do you think is the reason why these drugs come into the country? Is it lack or inaction by our government, our local authorities? Is it lack of communication between the two groups, as you said, you know, DEA, local authorities, local DEA authorities? What do you think the
bribery?
Bribery, yeah. What do you think is the reason why some of those things happen?
Well, I think first, my belief is that these drug cartels that get dramatized with movies like Scarface or misconstrued by Hollywood as to what they really are. These are no different than Fortune 500 or Fortune 100 corporations. People I dealt with were lawyers, they were doctors, corporate exec types that spoke three and four languages. Yes, Pablo Escobar was a violent man who ordered many people killed. But unlike these people who were dragged before cameras and shown as being the guy who killed this guy and that guy, the real power are the people who are behind them. You know, Pablo Escobar, I dealt with his principal advisor, his consigliere, a guy by the name of Santiago Uribe. Santiago was a professor of the University of Medellin. He was a practicing lawyer, and he dealt very much with the legislature in Colombia. He was the author of what was then the non-extradition law in Colombia that prevented us, the U.S. government, from extraditing Escobar to be prosecuted in the United States.
Right.
Many of the other people that I dealt with were very sophisticated people like that. They're in this business because it's profitable. It costs $500 to make a kilo of cocaine and $2,500 to get it to the United States when I was in the business. $3,000 investment, we sold it for $15,000, $16,000. When I say we, I was part of the group that sold it. I didn't sell it. I definitely was involved in helping those people who profited from that move money and invest money, all for the sake of ultimately taking down more than 100 of them, seizing about $600 million in assets and forfeitures, and taking down what was the seventh largest privately held bank in the world that was involved with them. But the reason they're in it is they're in it for profit. And the reason that there's profit is because there is demand.
Right, of course.
We are our biggest enemies. We have the population of the world that has the greatest appetite
means?
For illegal drugs.
Well, appetite
we
and
also
mean.
Are, we are also are a society, a country, that doesn't focus, in my view, adequately on education and treatment of drug trafficking, drug trafficker or drug users. I think that our prisons are filled in many cases with people who are sick and who are lower-level drug traffickers who get involved in the business because they're trying to make money to sustain their interests in getting more illegal drugs and resources to get those illegal drugs. And I think that those statistics come about because, unfortunately, sometimes people get lazy in the law enforcement community. I can tell you that there were many times when I and my colleagues would be told, listen, we need to get the numbers up. You know, you need to get out there and work with the local law enforcement agencies and adopt some of the local cases and take them into the federal system. Granted, these are people who needed to be punished in some fashion, but probably one of my watershed moments when I was thinking about retiring came. I'm pretty well known in the law enforcement community as being a guy who's very focused on trying to get at the command and control of these organizations and the international banks and businesses that launder money for them. Because hopefully
right.
before we're done, I'll get to talk about the role of the international banking community.
Please, I want you to. I would love you to.
And what I witnessed firsthand after trying to work some of those cases and failing in some instances. I mean, come on, you know, you got to keep trying to fight the fight, and, you know, you're not going to always win.
Right.
And but I was asked to go to a sentencing, as my colleagues in the office were asked to go because there were two young men who were about to be sentenced whose family had apparently made certain statements that suggested that they were going to try to retaliate against the case agent who worked on the case. And that's the last thing that I would ever want to see happen or any of my colleagues. So I was at the sentencing. And what I saw and what I heard were what I consider to be two young men, ages 20 and 21, they had sold crack cocaine for the third time. They were bad guys, no doubt. They were gun-toting. They were violent. They needed to be punished. But I could have held in my hands the amount of crack cocaine the evidence supported that they had distributed and for which they were about to be sentenced. And they were sentenced to life in prison. They're still in prison. And as I got ready to leave the courtroom, someone came up to me in the law enforcement community and said, "See, man, you're missing the way to go. This is like shooting ducks in a barrel. We can, you know, you can make a lot of cases like this. you know, working on those sophisticated bankers and all this other stuff, it's high risk, you know, this is really what you should be doing. And that convinced me that that's what I shouldn't be doing. And so not long after that, I decided to retire. What I find appalling and hypocritical is the knowing involvement of the international banking community and the international business community in the laundering of roughly $400 to $500 billion a year globally that comes about through the sale of illegal drugs. And also, if you look at the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime, their United Nations on Drugs and Crime report in October of 2011, it's pretty consistent with prior years' reports. There's roughly $2.1 trillion in illegal money that winds up moving around this globe every year. So that's big business. And now we look at what's happened in the last 4 or 5 years with respect to what happens when banks get caught with their hands in this kind of money. There's probably a dozen cases where banks, and I've written a paper about this, it's on my website, so and it's footnoted to every single indictment and every document that supports this. But there are a dozen banks, many of them are U.S.-based banks, international banks, that have knowingly gotten involved in the handling of proceeds from illegal activities, including drug trafficking. And what generally has happened is they've been allowed to enter into what's called a deferred prosecution with the Department of Justice. This is a document that says, I know you've got an indictment and you can charge me, and I admit that I committed the criminal offense, but rather than plead, I will correct my behavior. You can monitor my transactions for 12 months, and I will pay a fine. Prime example, Wachovia Bank in 2010, March of 2010, entered into a deferred prosecution with the Department of Justice.
I do remember.
They said, we committed a criminal offense in connection with our solicitation of deposits in Mexico, $400 billion, $400 billion with a B, $400 billion U.S. dollars that were taken in through correspondent bank relationships with what are called houses of exchange, casas de cambio.
Right.
Those houses of exchange have been for a decade noticed by the U.S. Treasury Department and other agencies to the banking community as the highest risk accounts that you can take. So they took in $400 billion in deposits. Frankly, try to wrap your mind around this.
Yeah.
That's one-third of the gross national product of Mexico for an entire year.
Yeah.
And it's in dollars. A country whose per capita income is $4,000 a year, and that's earned in Mexican pesos, not dollars.
Right.
So who did they think they were getting the $400 billion from? And among the other services that they provided was the transportation from Mexico back to the United States. And I say back because I was a money launderer undercover. I can tell you, I picked up, I and my fellow undercover agents picked up millions of dollars on an occasion, on separate occasions in different cities around the U.S. That's what happens first in the drug money laundering process. Then it's smuggled across our border south, and in this instance, propped up in houses of exchange to look legal. Now the money gets brought back. If that $14 billion had been in $20 bills, and I guarantee you it was not, because the pickups we make are in 5, 10s, and 20s,
right.
Make the package smaller, it's 20s, it would have weighed 725 tons.
Wow.
Who did they think they were getting 725 tons of cash from? So the outcome of that case is not one person goes to jail. The bank pays a $160 million fine, which equaled 2% of their profits,
right.
And life goes on. So we have that with Wachovia. We have it with Bank Atlantic in April of 2006, $20 million fine. Ocean Bank, August 2011, $11 million fine. American Express Bank International, 2007, $55 million fine. Union Bank of California, $21.6 million fine. You can go on to other banks handling other types of illegal transactions. For example, those banks that move money on behalf of U.S. dollar account holders to prohibited nations like Iran.
Iran.
These are nations that there are sanctions against dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? Lloyds Bank pays a $350 million fine in 2009 for doing that. Nobody goes to jail. Credit Suisse, pays $536 million, December of 2009, nobody goes to jail. ABN AMRO Holding, $500 million in May of 2010. Barclays Bank, August of 2010, $298 million, and I can go on. But the bottom line is that there is a hypocrisy here with respect to the enforcement of laws that impact on what's happening on the streets of the United States and in other countries when it comes to the distribution of illegal drugs. And the most important thing that needs to be done that hasn't been done in a long time is some very, very hard punishment for individuals within international banks and businesses who cater to this money and give it power. Because once they take it into the banking system and they enable these organizations to become professional appearing, they give them the power to undermine democracies, to pay off politicians, to pay off military and law enforcement, people, judges, whatever it is that needs to be done. That's what's going on in Mexico. That's what's happened in the past in Colombia, and it's going on now in nations in North Africa, which are the Mexico of the European routes for the Colombian traffickers. And countries like Mali, Togo, Benin, Ghana, Nigeria, Sierra Leone are all countries that are facing corruption now because of the fact that they are transshipment points for these huge amounts of drugs that are moving into Europe from South America. So the picture is much, much bigger than what's necessarily going on in our neighborhoods. But from our neighborhood standpoint, I really wish that we would be much more effectively involved in education and treatment, especially in those communities that are at greatest risk in our country. And because once we can begin to help those communities to reduce the interest in this drug, in these drugs, we will begin to have a longer range effect on what these cartels do and the power that they exert around the globe.
So you believe starting, and I hate to use the term starting from the rear, but you believe starting from the rear by getting rid of the customer, so to speak, this actually puts a little bit of a halt on what it is that, as far as the trafficking is concerned. You know, you don't have a customer, there's no reason to sell a product, is pretty much in essence what you're saying.
In part, because I think that at the same time, because there's no one button, there's no silver bullet.
Absolutely.
I think at the same time, we have to be very focused using the extremely valuable law enforcement resources that we have in focusing those resources on the prosecutions of the heads of the snakes. And I must say, I get the pleasure of dealing with a lot of very young men and women within law enforcement in the military community and the intelligence community, who are devoted to this fight. And there's been some work in the last few years by a particular unit within the Drug Enforcement Administration very few people know about, called the Special Operations Division. Now, they work closely with our military and intelligence communities, as well as with our allied counterparts in law enforcement, military, and intelligence. They have made some phenomenal cases in the last couple of years, and as far as attacking the heads of the snake, they're doing the job. There's a case your listeners should Google. Last name is Juma, J-O-U-M-A-A. That's J-O-U-M-A-A. Just put in Juma and money laundering or drug trafficking. You will see an indictment and charts that have been put out that basically tell this story. It's an alliance between the Colombian cartel's leadership, the Mexican cartel leadership, and Hezbollah. And the reason that Hezbollah is involved in this is because of their presence in the Middle East, in Lebanon, which is a major money laundering center, and in Africa, a major transshipment center. And their involvement in the drug trade is not to make money so that they can go buy Rolls Royces. They want to go out and buy things that are deadly
right,
against the Western world that they hate. And so now, unfortunately, things have been ticked up some, and our use of illegal drugs not only is putting money into the pockets of these ruthless drug traffickers, but also in the hands of terrorists who are going to want to end our way of life. And that Juma case, if it doesn't open everybody's eyes, then you really can't care. Beside the Juma case, they made the prosecution possible and of a guy by the name of Victor, V-I-K-T-O-R, Boot, B-O-U-T. He is the guy who, I've forgotten the name of the Cage, Nicolas Cage played his part as an arms dealer. He's the biggest arms dealer that this planet has ever seen, providing terrorist organizations around the world with illegal arms from missiles to you name it. And he wound up, as a result of the work done by the Special Operations Division, being lured to Bangkok for a supposed meeting. Actually, these were DEA informants acting as members of FARC, which is a leftist guerrilla terrorist organization in Colombia that's involved in drug trafficking. Got him to get to go to Bangkok, where he was arrested, fought the KGB and the Russians, and won to get extradition to New York. In this past year, convicted him in a New York courtroom, and wound up getting him a 30-year sentence, which is in effect a life sentence. And getting the heads of the snakes to talk, and prosecuting the heads of the snake, identifying the people within different branches of government that have been corrupted, that's an important part of this equation. So as bad as the whole game seems, there are good things being done by young, dedicated agents who are, in fact, involved in this fight of fights, very different than the conduct of those who designed and carried forward the Fast and Furious undercover operation that should have never gotten off the ground.
All right, on the phone with Robert Mazur, who is a former DEA agent and author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. You've been extremely enlightening. I'll ask you one last question, and I'll let you go. You talk about branches of government that have been been wined and dined and pretty much used in some of these actions. Are these still current branches of government? Are there names? Are there places that people can look up and find out, you know, what it is that they should be looking out for, or what it is that they should be paying attention to? Are these still ongoing investigations?
Well, I mean, you don't have to look back very far. If you want to look at the situation that's occurring in Mexico, your listeners can Google and look for some articles that came out just about a month ago concerning four high-ranking military officials in Mexico. These are one active general, two retired generals, and one retired lieutenant colonel, all of whom were on the take through the Beltran Yeva organization, one of the cartels in Mexico. The reason that we know about them and the reason that they have been detained while investigations are ongoing about their receipt of huge amounts of payoffs, and, you know, the Mexican cartels, not the Mexican cartels, but the Mexican military, when I was working undercover dealing with some very high-level people in the Medellin cartel, it was openly discussed that they had paid Mexican military personnel for the use of an airstrip on a military base. So that they could land huge aircraft full of laden with cocaine that was later brought into the United States. So it's not a new story, but this is a current story. And the reason that we know about this information is that there is one of the members of the Beltran Yeva organization who was a hitman by Edgar Valdez Villarreal, who wound up being prosecuted, taken into custody, and through him we now know he was the major guy who was passing money to these people. This is a good example of why it is that you have to go after the heads of the snake, because they're the only ones who really know what goes on in the shadows. So an example of the corrupting power of the Mexican cartel can be seen in that. I'll give you the names of one of the military people, and that'll take you into information about it. But just look for a guy, Silvio Hernandez Soto, S-O-T-O. He was the lieutenant colonel who's been detained. There are other military personnel in there. So, I mean, this type of stuff, unfortunately, happens far too frequently.
Wow. I have to admit, it's a lot. In fact, my producer just said, this is probably one of the best, you're probably one of the best guests we've had in a long time talking about this, and I appreciate your time on the show, and we hope to have you back as this Fast and Furious story develops, if you'd like to come back.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, and one of the things your listeners need to know is that there are a lot of federal law enforcement officers who really give a damn, and they are the people who will bring voice to the truth on this stuff. I know Senator Grassley personally. I've dealt with him when he was involved in designing aspects of the Patriot Act after 9/11. He's a good man. Unlike many politicians, he's not a lawyer. He was a school teacher. I think that in his heart, he really cares about the public. So there are good people who are on this who really want to do the right thing. And it's very easy, and I have in my own life quite often become quite cynical about all of this stuff.
Right.
But there are good people out there that are fighting for all of us every single day, and people who put their lives on the line for us every single day.
Which is why it's so important to get justice for Brian Terry.
You're right.
I think that's the heart of this case. And with people now like the Sharpins and these civil rights leader trying to make this a racial issue, they don't, you know, it's like they've completely ignored the fact that there are, what, 300 Mexicans dead. Brian Terry is dead. I forget Jaime's last name. I have no idea why I'm forgetting his name. It was the DA agent who was also killed. The reason why people are interested in this case is not about politics. This is about getting justice and putting an end to this. And I think people just want to – they just don't want this out there. They don't want the American public to know. And I think it's important that they know.
I couldn't agree with you more. The sooner they decide that they're going to turn over all these documents and let the subcommittees do the right thing, you know, there may be some things that shouldn't get out publicly, but the bottom line is the heart of the story needs to get out publicly so we can get back to building confidence between between the public and our politicians.
So you don't believe the White House is involved, even though they, you know, with the executive privilege thing? You don't think the White House is involved?
I just don't think I have enough information to even pass judgment on that. I really don't.
Right.
You know, there are some things that I don't have enough facts about that I believe. For example, I really don't believe Lee Harvey Oswald was the only assassin, and that there was somebody on the other side of the grassy knoll. So, but even being a grassy knoll conspiracy guy,
did you say you do or you don't believe?
Well, I do believe that there are other people involved. Absolutely. In my heart of hearts, I believe it. I don't believe that Lee Harvey Oswald did that by himself. I really don't.
Really? Well, you don't believe grassy knoll. It could have been a conspiracy, but I don't believe the grassy knoll had anything. There was anybody.
I think that might be where another shooter was located. But anyway,
I don't know. No
yeah, reason. But anyway, I'm going that far on that one. But I need a lot more facts, you know, on President Obama before venture an opinion on
and
what
executive
you were talking
privilege
about.
Does not even give you a little tinge of sort of, you know, I mean, come on, executive privilege, grassy knoll, come on. I mean,
my thinking is that some people are worried about this coming out before November, and I hope that isn't the case, but that was my first reaction, you know, uninformed reaction when I heard about the executive privilege.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how anybody could think otherwise. Well, thank you again. We appreciate you calling in. Again, Robert Mazur, the former DEA agent and author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. We appreciate it, and we will get in touch with your people. We'll have you on as soon as maybe after the contempt order. We'll see if we can get you on next week.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate getting the opportunity to share ideas with you.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it, too. All right, guys, that's our show for today. Mike, I'm sorry I didn't get to get you on. He had just a lot of information. I'll let Mike end the show with his tweets. We'll go through every one. Mike wanted me to ask him about the CIA's involvement in Freeway Rick Ross. I was wondering. I didn't even think of him. And I spoke to Freeway Rick Ross a couple of weeks ago. He also asked about a ton of coke ending up on the streets of Miami from Venezuela. Well, Mike, you should have stayed on the line for that one. And he says, it's because of the CIA, but this guy won't admit that. I think he actually just, I think he pretty much just indicted people in the government or branches of the government who were involved. I would have assumed by what he said that it was the CIA. I mean, who else could it be? He's already implicated DEA agents, ATF agents. I think that he's pretty much laid out everybody that was involved. But, great interview. JC, what'd you think before we go? You there?
I think I lost JC.
You there, JC? Okay, I can't hear you. Anyway, all right, that's our show.
We will see you guys tomorrow. Right here on the screen.